We of the West, powerful in ideas as well as in armed forces, are somewhat crippled. And there's a long history, I think, behind this decline in American prestige, a decline that started after World War II. Our Civil War last century was preceded by a profound debate about a matter with which the underdeveloped nations today are very well acquainted. This debate of ours concerned the meaning of the Declaration of Independence and its ringing words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident," and so on. In the 1850s and 1860s, there was much argument over the rights of men under the Declaration of Independence and over the status of Negroes in American constitutional law. Taney ruled in the Dred Scott case that Negroes, even though emancipated, remained inferior persons who had no rights or privileges, but such as those who held the power of government might choose to grant them. And Taney went on to say that while the Declaration of Independence would seem to embrace the whole human family, the members of the enslaved African race were not intended to be included. And he proved his point, to the satisfaction of some people at least, by showing that even in those states where slavery did not take hold, traffic in slaves was legalized, miscegenation statutes were enforced, and the Negro was not allowed many of the civic rights that the so-called dominant race enjoyed. And while a state might raise a Negro to a higher status, no state, he said, nor even Congress, could give any right of citizenship outside the particular territory where the Negro resided. This decision, as you all know, was one of the many incidents that triggered a debate that was more or less continuous over a decade. Some people of that era thought Taney went too far by including in the words, "All men are created equal, all white men." Does this mean that Poles and Hungarians and Jews are equal to the English and the Scotch and the Irish? Preposterous, said some. And so they settled for the proposition that when Jefferson said, "All men are created equal," he meant only that Americans were the equals of the Britishers. You know, just about a year ago, I was at a rally in a church in Washington, D.C., a Free Africa rally, whites and blacks. On the stage with me was Tom Aboja of Kenya, an old friend. And I was talking about that all men are created equal, meant all men, not just all white men. I was stopped at a reception a couple days later by a senior officer of our State Department who said that he was shocked to read in the press what I had said, that I apparently had misunderstood the Declaration of Independence, and I asked him in what respect, and he said, "The Declaration of Independence, written by Thomas Jefferson, meant only that Americans were the equals of the Britishers." And I said, "Mr. Secretary, this is where we came in 100 years ago. Because there was one man who was insistent that Jefferson, when he used the words all men, meant blacks, the browns, and the yellows, as well as the whites. There's no reason in the world," Lincoln said, "why the Negro is not entitled to all the rights enumerated in the Declaration of Independence, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I hold," said Lincoln, "that he is as much entitled to these as the white men, and the right to eat the bread without leave of anybody else, which his own hand earns. He is my equal and the equal of every other man," quote close. It took more than speeches to prove that Lincoln was right. It took the war and three constitutional amendments to seal the idea of equality into our constitutional fabric. And yet just a year ago, a senior officer of our State Department, as I have said, resisted the idea. In spite of these amendments, racial discrimination fastened itself into our communities, North as well as South. Americans of African and even Mexican descent were segregated into separate schools. And restrictive covenants became a way of life. I suppose here, I don't know about Los Angeles, but in areas in Washington, D.C., it is still true. And in spite of the federal financing of housing that has extended into the billions of dollars, those covenants are firmly rooted in most of our communities. and colored people are still excluded from juries and from the voting lists in many of our cities. Racial discrimination appeared even in government employment. State laws appeared aimed at the practice, and the 40s and the 50s saw progress. Yet Americans today do not speak in one voice. Racial discrimination is still a force for disunity. And many trade unions, either by reason of a constitutional provision in a charter or by reason of habit and practice, still bar Negroes. Teaching of the Declaration of Independence is not always remembered. The racial problem is only one of several that saps our strength. Automation promises to make the machine more dominant over man than ever before, and with that domination comes insecurity at the prospect of unemployment. And idleness, even when the idle people are paid, is a corrosive influence. As you all know, there's therapy and work. It creates joy and a sense of fulfillment. A nation of idle people is a weak nation, though everyone receives a handsome pension. This problem of the domination of the machine over man is not a new one. The mood of the 50s preceding 1861 is often referred to wistfully as the Romantic Age, yet there were then shaping up voices of discontent who were to be heard for a century. A working man's meeting of September 26, 1829 complained that there was as yet no system of education for the poor, that monopoly strengthened the aristocracy and reduced the power of the farmer, mechanic, and laborer, that half of society are the slaves of etiquette and the other of excessive labor, and that the producers of wealth are poor and dependent whilst the consumers are rich and powerful. The Gilded Age that followed the Civil War proved that those complaints were based on fact and that great reforms were necessary. For that age greatly exploited both our resources and our people. The Gilded Age was a laissez-faire period. During the 30-odd years of last century and the first decades of the present one, there's no almanac of liberty that would record many victories of human rights over the machine. The legal dimensions of the problem have greatly changed, but the central issue remains. Who will own the machines that supplant men? How will men find work that is so vital to human welfare? The civil service that was to save government from the spoiled system has produced vast bureaucracies that are heavy-footed and under watchful eyes. The loyalty security programs governing employees now reach into the private sector. All who do business with the government need security clearance. The engineer who has given his best years to reach a $15,000 a year salary loses everything if he's branded a poor security risk. Big corporations like big government and big unions breed non-controversial men and women. At the managerial, engineering, or administrative level, there may be debate and controversy, but on the larger public issues of the day, the voices of the employees are largely mute. The commercialism of television and radio has made like changes. Sponsors do not want their products identified with controversial programs nor with controversial commentators. There has been such a deadening effect of radio and TV on the American mind that we may have reached a point where men and women who will sponsor unorthodox points of view must be subsidized by some of our foundations. The dialogue that has characterized the free society has not disappeared from the American scene, though it has declined. We're passing through momentous times where no debate takes place, even on crucial issues. Laos is certainly more dangerous to all of us than the Missouri Compromise was to our ancestors. And while the Missouri Compromise was thoroughly discussed in and out of Congress and up and down the nation, no debate on Laos has been held. Why has silence overtaken us? Why has the pattern of no discussion reached into atomic testing, disarmament, Berlin, and other issues that involve the problems of survival or extinction? Is foreign policy the key to life and death for all forms of life in this nuclear age beyond the bounds of debate? If so, how can we, the people, ever free ourselves from military domination and assert our sovereign civilian prerogative over all affairs of state, over war as well as over peace. A survey of newspapers from coast to coast shows the lowest state of dialogue on domestic as well as foreign issues. Moneymakers have taken over the press. They want readers and advertisers, and so they cater to the low common denominator in the populace. Those who live in the average American town, such as my hometown of Yakima, have no chance of getting an accurate measure of the world problem. Ignorance alone is tragedy enough. Further tragedy lies in the fact that the people of the United States, the ones who could, if awakened, take up the challenge of the Cold War and win it, are largely immobilized. Fears of communism are subtly transformed into fears of the unorthodox. The affluent society is also partly responsible. Those who live in ease are not the ones to go in search of the Holy Grail. And that's why I often think that the little band of recruits in Israel are much closer to the heartbeat of the times, much closer to the wavelength of the peoples of the world than we. Yet more recruits are needed today, recruits not only from Israel, but from America and all the other countries of the Western societies. They're more needed today for our modern crusade than ever before. The Pentagon, that gets roughly $45 billion a year, which, by the way, is greater than the total annual income of 600 million Chinese last year, also makes for conformity. Through 1,000 influences that reach us since World War II, we are conditioned to the idea that the Pentagon has the answer to communism, and for far too many years we have rested secure in that belief. Containment of communism by military programs became a sort of a new Maginot Line. Each of us became a sort of a military expert. What islands should we surrender? Should not the East Berlin Wall be demolished? While the Marshall Plan worked well in Europe, it was not suited to the underdeveloped areas. We overlooked the fact that our foreign aid program was used not to reestablish viable democratic societies, but to shore up old feudal regimes. And so dollars and guns, not ideas of freedom, were our security. People who see a world packed with communists, or who will make no pacts with communist nations, are more and more ready to accept the security of military solutions. The danger of the impact of this psychology on us as a people was summarized by Eisenhower in his famous farewell message to the nation. Quote, "In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never," he said, "let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals so that security and liberty may prosper together," quote close. The tie-in between our military and our industry is no casual thing in a few communities. 3 out of 4, even 5 out of 6 families are dependent directly or indirectly on Pentagon largesse. What would happen in city after city if real disarmament was announced tomorrow? Transferring our economy from a military to a consumer regime would present difficulties comparable to taking a human being off drugs. The influence of the Pentagon abroad is destructive of the democratic ideal. It has almost always been identified with kings or feudal overlords whose pretenses of reform have been hollow. Thanks largely to the Pentagon, Thailand has lost all the momentum of her 1932 revolution and has now reverted back to the kind of dictatorship she knew in the 15th century. Is that the American influence in the world of which we're proud? The truth is that the Pentagon feels much more at home in Saudi Arabia or South Korea or Taiwan than in places like Israel and India, where there's a true political renaissance underway. A strong internal police is necessary in any country. Police forces are especially necessary in fragile nations, but arming the feudal overlords in the manner we've done is something else. Asia, Africa, and Latin America have never known democracy or liberty or freedom. Those terms are empty and hollow. A few men or a few families own the country, and the rest are serfs. There are few, if any, schools, few, if any, doctors, few, if any, opportunities to escape the slavery or ignorance, illiteracy, and disease of the area. The jeeps of the Pentagon that roar through those villages bring no message of hope. The regimes we arm and support with lavish funds usually have no programs of reform. Due largely to the Pentagon influence, our heroes seem to be the dictators. That is one reason why the tides of history are running against us. At home, the military is more and more implicated in policy making. Each branch of the armed forces has its own State Department. The independence of nations is but one sign of ferment in the world. No matter what the Pentagon says, the feudal societies are doomed. Overseas, the people's protests are being heard more and more. Hunger, disease, illiteracy, exploitation, and misgovernment, these are the enemies. The peoples of the world are going to be done with them. Revolution after revolution is going to be launched. Are we to credit every revolution to the communists? Is every overseas reformer to be suspect? Demands for reform and revolution are expressions of the world's unrest. The Pentagon and the CIA overseas search out men who temporarily crush the dissidents. But popular unrest is so deep that attempts to stomp it out only strengthen the communists. The problem is not to quell the revolutionaries, it is supply and support democratic cadres who will direct the reforms and manage the turbulent days ahead. This requires, my friends, a vast reorientation. We must be prepared to send to the blighted areas tens of thousands of teachers who will establish teacher training schools. These teachers must speak the local language and be prepared to stay abroad for years. We must have brigades of doctors and nurses overseas to help establish medical schools, nurse training schools, first aid centers, and hospitals. Tens of thousands are needed at the agricultural level. The idea of a cooperative is as unfamiliar to the villagers of Asia, Africa, and Latin America as Einstein's formula is to most of us. Yet cooperatives are the answer to many problems. Where are the men who can speak the languages of the world and who will make up our teams of teachers to show overseas villagers how to farm and manage cooperatively? Some of the new nations do not even have plumbers, let alone architects of the free society. Technicians as well as political scientists must be trained. We must be prepared to export hundreds of experts and task forces who speak the local language and who can show hungry and illiterate yet eager people how to lay the foundations of a free society. The communist bloc has detailed blueprints of a new society for each underdeveloped nation. These plans do not call merely for the assassination and execution of the feudal overlords and the Democrats. Their project, of course, starts there, but it moves on to detailed plans touching every aspect of a society, from farming to medicine, from press censorship to music and to dancing. We in America have developed exportable houses that anyone who can read an instruction book can assemble. The Soviet bloc, however, has an exportable society with tens of thousands of experts, each speaking the local language, ready for overseas work. That is the measure of our competition now that war as a result of the nuclear bomb has become obsolete. And if you have any doubt of that, go to Outer Mongolia and see how Russia has transformed a pastoral society into a modern industrial society in 15 years. Where are our troops for this kind of political contest? If we were in the mood for this kind of adventure, we would have student advisors in all our high schools and colleges creating interest and curiosity among students and steering them into even the exotic languages such as Telugu, Tamil, and Mongolian. Yet over half our high schools in this academic year, 61 to 62, offer no foreign language. Of the leading 83 world languages, we are prepared in a degree to teach some 50. The rest, however, are not yet known to us. This undertaking, the transformation of primitive pastoral societies to modern ones, is the nub of the Cold War. These underdeveloped nations constitute the battleground. It is there that the contest will be won or lost, for that contest turns on the political balance in the world. To help these new nations lay the foundations of a free society requires some money, but people and ideas are even more important than money. Schweitzer in Africa, my friends, gives a measure of the inspiration of just one human being in a benighted area. Samuel Jordan of California, who lived close by here, who spent 40 years in Iran teaching English, brought more profound influence to that ancient land in the direction of a free society than the $2 billion we have poured in there since World War II. We of the West, including Israel and India, must multiply the Schweitzers and the Jordans by 100,000 or even more. Has the American sense of adventure, the American experimental attitude, been dulled by the affluent society? Will the people who practice discrimination at home be eager evangelists of equality abroad? Are we sufficiently tolerant to permit our people and our aid to construct socialist societies in other nations? Is free enterprise, now greatly transformed in this country and only a shadow of its original form, still such a powerful symbol as to immobilize us from unorthodox work abroad? Is the unorthodoxy that has caused the left to disappear at home and that has resulted in a polarization of political thought at the center and to the right going to paralyze us for revolutionary deeds abroad? Can we make revolution a respectable word, or have we given the communists a monopoly on it? These are soul-searching questions concerning America that are as yet unanswered. There can be no doubt that the Cold War would be easily won if we released abroad our technical skills, our humanitarian impulses, and the idealism of the Declaration of Independence. Are we so wedded to orthodoxy and the ease of the affluent society that we will lose by sheer default? In the period of the Three Kingdoms, 221 to 277 AD, there was a Chinese strategist by the name of Kung Ming. He was also the prime minister. His rare capacities made him a hero of the Chinese people. He made several military inventions for military use, including a bow that shot several arrows at once. In one campaign, he had his fleet in excellent condition. They were awaiting the enemy and could easily have won. As he paced the bridge of the ship leading the fleet, he said, "We have everything in readiness. We are stronger than the enemy. All we need now is an east wind." And that is our predicament today. Will we too fail for lack of that east wind? If the mood of this day reflected the spirit of the Declaration of Independence, the Renaissance would have arrived. Then the ideas of equality would energize us and result in an outpouring of talent for work overseas in villages where ignorance, poverty, and filth pile high. Then the idea of the consent of the governed would become a principle worthy of honor in the most backward nation. It would take fire at home and bring into all phases of our foreign policy a concern for people rather than for power blocks and military bases. If the Jeffersonian ideas and the Declaration possessed us, revolution would be our slogan, revolution against feudal regimes as well as revolution against colonial powers. The problem of exporting revolution is extremely complicated. It requires dedicated democratic cadres who are native to the society being reorganized. It necessitates great flexibility in the political and economic patterns which are designed for the new nation. The export of our institutions without the use of vast controls might do more harm than good. Mexico had a revolution 40 years ago, and a recent report from the University of Mexico shows how the gap between the rich and the poor has widened ever since. Between the years 1910 50 and 1957, Mexico's industrialization greatly benefited the growing middle class, but it also let the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. While overall family incomes rose 23%, the bottom one-fifth of Mexican families' share of national income dropped from 6.1% to 4.4%, and their average monthly earnings fell from $22 to $19.80. The next 30% of Mexican families, just a cut above them, barely managed to maintain their 1950 income levels. The biggest rewards of industrialization, which sent gross national product soaring 48% in the 7 years, went to the top 30% of Mexico's families, who increased their real income by some 30%. The topmost 5% did best of all, skimming off 37% of national income in 1957. The losers by industrialization were mostly unskilled farm laborers driven from the land by mechanization and drawn to the cities. The product of this industrialization is thus a restless mass common to most Latin American countries. It is more difficult for people in an affluent society to acquire a revolutionary mood than those whose economies are marginal or even worse. It is more difficult for people far removed from their own revolution, such as we are, to experience that mood than for those who have only recently won independence. That is evident from a comparison of the spirit that pervades Israel today with the more conservative mood of the West. Yet there's nothing inevitable in historic processes that makes long-established regimes unable to become evangelists of radical ideas and to promote at home and abroad the ideas of the free society that offer liberty and equality to all. Father Buckberger recently summed the matter up in the following words: Marxist reasoning ends in a paradox. Any resistance to revolution and its unavoidable demands imperils the liberty and equality that revolution alone can bring. The liberty of today must be violently suppressed to ensure the liberty of tomorrow. The terror of today is justified in the name of the liberty of tomorrow. He goes on to say, the American Declaration, on the contrary, affirms that liberty and equality can never wait, that without them life has no human dignity. The American Declaration affirms that chaos itself is better with liberty and equality than the most harmoniously designed political and social order without them. It recognizes that man comes ahead of society. Man creates society. He is not created by society. There is no limit to man's revolutionary hope. That is the spirit that today possesses our Peace Corps. It is also the spirit that possesses Teodoro Moscoso and the Alliance for Progress. Will it also possess our vast bureaucracy? Will it be reflected in legislative halls? Will it set the mood in our classrooms and pulpits? If it does, we will not lack the east wind that is necessary to win this Cold War. For once the peoples of the world feel the force of the free society and see that it is built on the creed of liberty and equality, democracy can become the most contagious influence on all the continents.